Okay. I'm a grasshopper, so this will be going all over the place. So forgive me in advance. I didn't want to pin down a specific institutional base for my contribution to the discussion, because a little bit like you, Ulf, I've been moving across a number of different institutions, and I think the frameworks that they have offered in terms of the raison d'être of this symposium are actually possibly quite valid. So I'd like to put them out there, and then we can see how this can feed the discussion. So to try and think on my feet about questions that are arising here, I would like to come back to several different organizations which have organizational models, different roles of the artistic process, the artistic input to collaborative research processes. And, of course, more recently, I've been involved in two universities in the UK. But I would like to go back to perhaps also to reference experience running a French art school, which is quite an unusual beast in terms of artistic research. It's an extremely, chaotic beast in some ways. And also working on European framework projects in the 90s, fourth framework, which was when the European Commission began to bring artists into IT development processes. And so I gave my my subject the generic focus on values, because I think what the people I'm working with at the moment are most interested in trying to identify are the different sets of values when you have an interdisciplinary collaborative community. It is bringing to bear very different sets of values into the work process. And those values are they're kinds of dissonance in a way. They're sources of friction. They're also sources of real exchange. I think if there were no friction, there would not be real exchange across these different components. But they are also very heavily time-driven. And I think, Irène, already you mentioned this question of there isn't time to do certain things. And there has been repeatedly reference to the time structures that govern certain sorts of collaborative processes. So I'm very interested in seeing how one might take temporal windows and move them across a collaborative system to see where those temporal windows are bringing to the foreground or pushing into the background different sets of values. So, for example, if we talk about the contractual delicacies of involving artists in labs, then I would want to go back to the contractual delicacies of artists being brought on board European framework projects in the mid-90s. Andreas was familiar with some of the conflicts surrounding some of these projects. For example, I was working at the ZKM. We engaged Nobotic Research on a fourth framework project, which had to do with building artistic, radical artistic thinking into the conceptualization of distributed computing, linked up spaces, information architectures, if you like. And the goal was noble, the goal was appreciable, the goal was in the what I see as the genuine European Erasmus humanist terms, a very good one. The problem was aligning the objectives and the temporal windows that govern, for example, an artist or an artist partnership or trio, like Nobotic Research, but I could be talking about others, into a 5-year or 3-year time frame imposed by the European Commission with a number of types of deliverables and outputs. So we're building on, you use the term, Ulf, the social capital of parents. In this instance, we were building the social capital of pre-existing artistic practices into a time-bound, very formally circumscribed research and development process. It was highly conflictual because not only was the European Commission, although in those days they were a lot more enlightened than the ones I know now, but not only were they interested in fairly tangible outputs, in outputs that would be transferable to the European market, but also the cultural institutions, for example, the ZKM, had their own vested interests in maintaining their hold over the artistic property that was generated through these collaborative processes. And ultimately, in some instances, the people who derived the least recognition and satisfaction out of this kind of project were the artists. Basically, if one were to speak crudely, you could say that the artists were being ripped off in some cases. In some cases, this was real. In some cases, this was potential. But in any case, there was always this tension. So my job at the ZKM, in part, was to bring artists on board these collaborative processes. And that was very complicated because, for me, it meant that we had to spell out as clearly as possible the terms of engagement. So we had to issue a call, which is perhaps similar to the kinds of calls that you have to build, to see who might be interested in working on what sorts of thematic frameworks. When we started to look at the IP questions, for example, that we wanted to make as explicit as possible to avoid future ambiguity, our calls became incredibly complicated. And how does one build in these extremely complex, sometimes extremely long-standing legacies that an artistic project represents? How does one build that into something that is as watertight as a clearly framed European research project? And these were integrated projects. They were multi-million euro IPs. That's integrated project as opposed to intellectual property, although sometimes you would wonder. So it was a very complex process with a lot of tensions, and I was very uncomfortable with it. And at one point talked to my project manager about how can we make these problems and these frictions more explicit so that they can inform these European collaborative communities. And I was told, oh, you have to write a deliverable. You have to write a deliverable where you actually spell out the tensions that are in this community. So in one of our European framework deliverables, which is, of course, online, because it wasn't one of these confidential aspects, it was more generic, it was more ethical, so anybody could read it, there is a chapter about the commissioning process in these kinds of projects. And for me, I think some of the issues that were raised then are still extremely relevant because they are to do with the shifting temporal windows with which we are ascribing value to the different components of a collaborative community. So that's one thing I want to mention, and please cut me off at any point if you want to or need to. The next thing was... I went from the ZKM to run an art school in...
To pick it up later on, because it's a very interesting point, because I have the impression that sometimes artists as well as researchers would use art as something, because it has a different time frame. I mean, I will probably spell this out later, but there was a scientist even asking me if I could produce an art piece, because art could keep things going for 100 years. And as a science maker in its context, she could not, and that's a time frame of 2 or 5 years. I mean, that probably comes back later. Okay. Just to
no, that's a really that's a very relevant point. Thank you, Jens, for the sorts of things I'm trying to get at, because one of the fundamental differences I would like us to come back to at some point, and I think Andreas raised it this morning, and Martin, we talked about this last night, between artistic and scientific processes and goals, possibly, is the fact that, for me, an artwork's irreducibility as an artwork is bound up with its profound and willful and very deliberate ambivalence. And this ambivalence is what makes an artwork, in the longer term, eminently open to interpretation. Whatever scientific processes one might be engaged in, however eclectic and esoteric they might be, one is seeking clarity within one's own field. I think an artist is seeking something of a different nature and a different order. But this is where the discussion is to...
Well, I think that, to be honest, I think we should have it now. This, because there's no obligation to for you to do the presentation in one go. And I think there's also no obligation for us not to pick up things after the lunch break. Yeah. So I think that this is an important point. So.
I have two interesting examples, which are from the natural science. And one time frame is used or wanted to be used by a scientist and the other by an artist. I just exhibited a project by Adam Brown, an American artist, and he is rebuilding this Miller-Urey experience from the 60s, where with this primordial soup and putting gases together and to light it by a kind of it's a chiller, and it's producing these amino acids that supposedly gave life. So it's a project that many people say, well, it's just a science demonstration. What has art to do with that? And then the scientists come in and say, well, I can never do this now because Miller have done this and all this knowledge is hidden. But within the context of art, and with the national government funding, we can develop even this research which is not focused on very precise questions. It's trying it out. It's kitchen science, but we can do this through the scope of an art project. So the other counterexample exactly on this prebiotic research was when I discussed with Günther von Kiedrowski, who is one of the forerunners in prebiotic research of systems chemistry. And he said, well, it would be nice to do an arts and science project together because the Americans do it all in space and the Europeans do it all in time. And when we look for life outside the universe, outside the Earth, of course, we want to find something that we could find on Earth when we would run a 100 years experiment. So he was trying to make a kind of time capsule of prebiotic research, but he said, well, the only social system to permit this is art. So can we please build a kind of installation that is just fixed for 100 years? So it's the longevity of art or something that we know that can preserve something that would be then theoretically or hypothetically be used by a scientist as an argument, while the other way around. I mean, there's something about time frame which is not bound to institutions, but to a social and cultural practice. That was, I mean...
Well, oh, sorry, please. No, just see if I have anything... My thoughts have anything to do with what you're interested in. I'm not sure of that, but it suddenly came to my mind this kind of pretty rough and simple model you have in economics, actually, which is the transactional model of a guy called Williamson, sort of speaking. But and you said that you went into a situation where the only possible way out would be to write down the complete contract, to make the complete contract, to make it transparent, and to be able to sort of regulate and formulate and articulate and make transparent all the intricacies of actually what it is to work in an institution. Now, Williamson's way of tackling this is to say that some situations are impossible to write down, therefore you are actually working in hierarchies, which means that there is an arbiter or someone that's making the decision. And I'm just thinking about, I mean, the reaction you get, there's first of all, does it have anything to do with that? And second, is it a sign of an enormous naivety from scientists, maybe too, and artists, when it comes to actually realizing things in the world?
No, I think the writing down, it would be impossible, of course, to inscribe, to encapsulate in writing the complexities of the situation that we were in. The almost flippant answer of an EU project manager when you have a real problem in a research process is, instead of it becoming a stalemate, is to say, we can generate more material from this blockage as long as you spell it out, spin it out in a deliverable form. So I don't think anybody had any illusions about how deeply that writing process could encapsulate the politics, the complexity of the cultural politics we were engaged in. But at the same time, I think it was actually within the consortium, it was quite useful to spell out some of the major tensions. That piece of writing became an instrument for people across the consortium. And for me, it's an interesting yardstick because it goes back to 1996 or 97, and I've been able to see from mapping different sorts of situations how things have evolved. For example, with increased awareness of wider social science or sociological factors by a research community. There are cultural shifts in the ways people are thinking about these things. If I look back at this text now, it does look very, it looks very 90s.
You were also implying that actually the artists were living in another kind of existence than.
I think what I'm trying to get at is that the artists at that point in time, in the mid 90s, it was the first time that they were being directly and actively solicited by large scale integrated research projects with massive funding, and they tended to represent a fairly minimal portion of that funding, naturally, but I think a lot of the naivety or the problems that arose were from the fact that this was a new situation.
Well, and possibly also the fact that for the legitimation of these projects, the input from the artists was really important,
yeah.
Was crucial,
yeah.
But it was totally, that importance was totally out of balance with
the remuneration,
the share that they had,
yeah,
and the kind of the attention in the real work that was getting done,
yeah.
That they actually had,
yeah,
and the credits that they drew from those, and I think I can remember some other situations where artists realized this, that they were actually able to tip the balance of the project, kind of winning or failing, and they were really able to kind of renegotiate their contracts and kind of have a different play in this. But I think that in the logic of those kinds of projects, it's very important to, you know, define, maybe even protect artistic work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why I think I come into this discussion of the arts program here and continuously say it's about artistic projects, it's about the artistic work, and whatever happens in terms of contacts with the different disciplines has to, for the artists, has to benefit them, and then in a second step can also further the dialogue, kind of have results in thinking about interdisciplinarity, maybe even gain money from teaching jobs. But that is secondary to the artistic work.
Yeah. Replique or answer to that, or my interpretation of what you're saying is, we are going to build hierarchies, and these hierarchies are going to protect the artists. I mean, this is very blunt, kind of. But there is maybe another way. And if you look at what happens in art schools today, I think actually that something has happened since the mid-90s to today in the art schools. Mm-hmm. And it seems like maybe what's happening in the discussion what goes on is more of a, I would say, kind of looking at case by case discussion, the possibility of negotiating something in an institutional setting and doing things, so to speak, out there, and all the problems that this implies, and sort of getting to know the art world, getting to know the galleries, getting to know the things much earlier. I mean, the old style was just to leave them out as individuals, being protected by nice professors now and then. But so, I mean, there is another. An art program could actually envisage many ways, and that's one way, and there are other ways too.
Yeah.
But you see, I, having run an art school for 6 years, that raises other problems related to a protectorate, because if one has, we had some extremely good teachers who were very fluent with the mechanisms of the art market and the gallery system in Paris. They knew exactly where to place their students' work. You know, this one goes to Jennifer Flay, this one goes somewhere else. And in fact, that was becoming a very self-referential machine for feeding the art industry, the fiacre or whatever. And I must say that I found that just as excruciating for very different reasons to the conflicts that we had at the ZKM. We were not trying to build bridges between artists and another community as we were at the ZKM with the IT researchers. But what was happening, for example, at the École Supérieure Limage or otherwhere in France, was that the art students were being geared towards certain dissemination circuits. So the hierarchy was kicking in a different way. To come back to maybe the UK...
There was a question from Timon.
Oh, sorry.
Maybe not even a question, but I would be interested in your opinion on it, but maybe more a comment, because I thought your last point before the discussion are very interesting on this difference between artistic practices, however heterogeneous they are, and sort of scientific practices or research practices. And I wonder whether an art program shouldn't have this as a kind of a ongoing reflection in a way, because on the one hand, as you have all these theories that Ulf has mentioned, these free-floating theories that can help you make sense of that, you know, from percept, concept, effect, to Luhmann's codings, to Rancière, it's all aesthetic anyway, so you can all... But on the other hand, what you can observe, as far as I can see, is art universities, at least in the German-speaking realm, becoming more theoretical. Perhaps, you talked about institutional critique, and of course new forms of conceptual art and the ethnographic turn to art becoming more theoretical. And at the same time, at least part of the social sciences showing a keen interest in artistic methods, from action research, tinkering with artistic methods, to visual methods, to all this, to measures for atmosphere. So I just think it's very important to have this as kind of an ongoing reflection during the whole program on how these practices relate or not.
I think one of the names we mentioned last night, Timon, when we were briefly discussing, somebody like Nigel Thrift talks about effective contagion, and this whole politics, space and affect subtext of his non-representational theory. I think he I don't know whether he features yet on the tables of drifting across theorists, but I think it's very interesting to see how agilely Thrift has resuscitated a whole bunch of quite key social theorists, whether it's Gabriel Tarde or a philosopher like Ernst Bloch and the notions of hope, and this importance of the effect of contagion that is quite specific to art, as I see it, as being a really, really important social driver. So I think this, constantly debating. It's not something that can be resolved, this question of how and where art relates to other ways of thinking or doing. But I think it's very valuable to keep constantly debating its specificities. So,
can I suggest that you make your remark and then we break for lunch and then we just pick it up afterwards?
Okay,
again?
Fine.
Yeah.
I just want to throw in that I think it's really more important to ask why people have started, decision makers, art schools, etc., have started to throw artists into this direction and have this sort of normalization of the artist in something which is fundamentally a market, mm-hmm. a market of knowledge, of production of knowledge and of science, and how the artists being approached by decision makers referring to something or drawing very heavily on upon something which is a mythology of what artistic production and creativity is, and the whole myth of creativity that has been shown in the 90s, I think, is really the key to why all this is happening.
So I just want to say, at least innovation, not to creativity, but innovation, which is related to that innovation always comes from the periphery, not from the center.
Mm-hmm.
So this seems to be an insight from network theory that we have to believe in, I think. So not from the well-settled course of whatever, economics or science or scholarship, but always from the periphery. And maybe that was the hope of the industry when industry sponsored for some decades the interactive media endeavors with very, very expensive machines. I don't think it paid off for industry, at least. But maybe, anyway, this could be an aspect of inviting other people than the normal ones to work with the stuff that is in at the university. That is another aspect. It comes from the periphery of whatever is done there, because it wasn't there before. And in an abstract way, this could steer innovation. Then.
Yeah, that's another tricky word, isn't it? Innovation.
Yes.
Because if Irene was talking about the publication orgy, was it? Somebody
orgasm.
Orgasm. Sorry. then the innovation orgasm is another one, I think. Just to try and reconnect with what we were saying earlier, I just wanted to throw another word into the pot, which is, I think, a nice one, which comes from a French artist philosopher called Louis Beck, who talks about savanturier, which I think is a beautiful word, because the savant as the person who knows and the aventurier, and he talks about artists as savanturier. And also, as he says, that the humans are driven by exploratory tropisms. So we're constantly trying to explore, let's say, the peripheries, the boundaries of the spaces within which normative functions take
place.
Does
he write it with or without apostrophe?
What? Savanturier, he writes it without an apostrophe.
Okay,
of
because
course.
If you write it with, it means to get lost in something.
Yeah. No,
Savanturier.
Savanturier.
Okay,
c'est le verbe. Oui. Savanturier, okay. C'est. Donc, il n'y a pas de confusion possible.
Okay.
So Louis has this expression about creative extremophiles haunted by exploratory tropisms, by the irresistible attraction for aggressive biomes, vague and dangerous zones, inhabited by the inclination to overturn taboos, tormented by the bulimic greed for immoderately accumulating knowledge, obsessed with the curious idiosyncrasy of creating utopian worlds. So I think there are some drivers of artistic energies that perhaps are shared to a certain degree by some of the bulimic scientific greed for immoderately accumulating knowledge. But I just think those are quite nice typical Louis Beck terms to throw in. Talking about innovation, I think there is a, with any of these buzzwords, there are going to be abuses and traps, and some of the criticism that one might encounter, particularly in the UK in creative industries, has to do with recuperation and appropriation of the notions of innovation by the experience economy, by the Pine and Gilmore type of work. I don't know, you would be much better placed, Pierre, than I am to talk about this, but the fact that rather than artistic product or even artistic process as being something that we value, we are valuing and commodifying certain sorts of unusual experience. And so the experience economy is simply a commodification and a repackaging of these kinds of unusual adventures that art might offer us. So I think that's quite an interesting thing to throw in. And I just want... Did you want to say something, Pierre?
Yes.
Go on, please do.
No, that's true. Of course, that is what has come out of the Pine Gilmore thing.
Yeah.
But the Pine Gilmore, they are sort of claiming that the problem is a commodification.
Yeah.
And the problem is that everything is commodified all the time. So I think the basic kind of idea which one could sort of criticize and discuss is their main thing, that you have to price everything.
Yes.
If you can't price things.
But you see, this is where the values, this is where the values question arises. And I think we saw some good examples, whether we agree with them or not, in the exhibition. I think something like Buren, obviously, is
No, go on.
Yeah, anyway. And I just wanted to, because I don't want to eat other people's time this afternoon, but... to keep it loose, but Andreas also asked me to talk about the relevant stuff, perhaps, from university and research experience in the UK that I might be able to relate to you. One thing that is perhaps relevant is Culture Lab, which is an interdisciplinary research lab I founded in Newcastle. It opened its doors in 2006. I spent 2 years building physically the environment. The projects that run there, the research projects, do involve artists, some of them, not all of them, but they are mixed economy projects. And I think, Pierre, you were asking earlier about what would happen if private finance came to bear in the sorts of environments we're talking about. So what I found interesting running a place like Culture Lab, which was actually funded initially £5 million worth of science research infrastructure funding, was that we would have under the same roof projects that had artists working on them that were sponsored or funded or partly funded by Philips or Microsoft, Cambridge, or IBM, or Leverhulme. Unilever. We had Unilever, which was the industrial arm, and then Leverhulme, which was the philanthropic arm. And sometimes there would be very interesting debates between the artists and scientists as to what their purchasing power, if you'll forgive the metaphor, within the collaboration was in terms of who was financing. Sometimes there was a lot more freedom. For example, in a Microsoft-sponsored project, I'm thinking, for example, of a DJ artist who was giving very valuable input on gestural virtuosity to an interface development project, developing turntables. He had turntable skills that were being used to develop new sorts of tabletop displays. He felt that he had a very open experimental ground working under this Microsoft banner, whereas other people who had remits from the research councils or from philanthropic bodies had much more directed research projects because the nature of the deliverables was much more constraining. So I think we have to be very careful about caricaturing private funding as being systematically more... directivist, or what's the word, dirigiste, than public funding. The hybrids are often a lot more complex than we realise. The other thing about Culture Lab is the fact that we built a physical building precisely, we scoped it to accommodate new sorts of interdisciplinary collaborations. So basically I had an old 19th century building, it was a ruin, that I had to turn into 21st century infrastructure. So the way to do this was to pull together potential users and to have them as a collective co-shape the way that we physically reconstructed the space. I think there are a lot of reasons to be very reticent about the importance of capital infrastructure, about physical buildings in research collaborations, because people too often put the big capital buildings before the horse, which is the energy, the human energy and the creative energy. But we had an interesting opportunity to actually scope the space, literally network it. We built in its nerve center and we built in its circulation system in order to allow certain sorts of collaborative interactions. So it was a matter of patching spaces together. I saw the building as physically a kind of a systemic structure, a living systemic structure. And the real object was to enhance the circulation and to have a very loosely distributed, reconfigurable anatomy, if you like. So spaces can be an interesting question. I think they can be overblown as a question. It's very dangerous. But they can also be a very interesting question when you're talking about proxemics and how does one bring people together to discuss and to work in different ways. It does also have to do with the ways that we sit around a table and the ways we hierarchize our spaces. And so at the moment, I have the crazy job in Sussex of, rebuilding a building. This time it's a theatre with a 350-seat auditorium, which is the central piece, but then several rooms around it. And I'm trying to see how, again, involving a user community from right across the University of Sussex, so working a lot with informatics and with the medical sciences as well as with the humanities and the arts, how we can create a space that will be a catalyst for a different kind of collaboration across the university. One of the areas I've been working in for, 25 years is... coming from theatre, is motion capture. I'm very interested in gesture and restitution of fine gesture. And it's been a constant in my own work, but in Sussex we have an important motion capture technology development project working with archaeologists, computing scientists, dancers, cultural theorists. We're working on an archaeological site and we're developing wireless motion capture equipment for people to actually move around a large site and for us to be able to track their movements and to learn from their behaviours on an archaeological site. It's a Roman site in Silchester. And what is really interesting, it's something, Andreas, you said earlier, is that the technology that is being developed, this is Kirk Wolford who's driving this project, it's core for the funding. We've got £500,000 worth of funding for this, but it's also, in a way, being made healthily subservient to the intellectual mix of dancers, choreographers, archaeologists, cultural theorists. It's arising secondarily to the discussion across these people, which is something that you said earlier about one of the projects that you showed us. So maybe those are the bits of shrapnel that I wanted to throw into the arena to kickstart again. Mm. Is that enough to run with?
Let's see.
In what context is like this innovation, like for example with this project, do you see any connection like with what you're working on now with this, it would be really easy to maybe also bring it into connection with this innovation thought, or what you're, yeah, yeah.
Well, we wouldn't have got the funding if we hadn't told the funders that it was a very innovative project. So, actually, in Newcastle, we had this really interesting conversation with computer scientists, and they'd invited this very prestigious scientist, a computer scientist, and we had this dinner, and he was asking me about the projects we were doing in Culture Lab, and I was explaining some of them, and they're quite wacky. And he was very surprised that we were getting funding from the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council. And he said, but how do you convince the funders? And I just said, well, I lie. And but actually, which is sort of true, but
you're
sort of not.
Their hopes.
I'm playing with their agendas. Yeah, sure. I don't think they have anything I don't think hope is the right word. If hope
well,
is a, but I should be very careful because I know that we have funders sitting in the room. But well, it's what we were talking about at lunchtime. Actually, it's how do you attach a coherent narrative to a research endeavor that means that a funder feels that this can come under their umbrella. So I wasn't quite lying.
No, I mean, but this is actually a fact. I mean, also like the funding schemes and also the people that are actually sitting in these funding offices, they are most of the time, I think, also really concerned with, because they see also that there is a field changing, but like the schemes in which they have to kind of act are like too far behind.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a constant, also a constant problem and discussion also within the funding agencies. You know, they see like, I think a lot of these funders see the problematic of that it should be changed, like a lot of ways of how, what kind of Gefäße, or how do you say, there are exactly. Mm. And but it's not changeable that quickly, I think.
I think it's very difficult to generalize because, for example, in the UK, there are programs where the funders will very proactively seek out the people they think are the academics who can inform the ways they will put out the calls. Mm-hmm. The trouble is, and not just in UK academia, this also happened for some time in my experience when I was working a little bit in Holland, Virtual Platform was being consulted really as a reference body for the Dutch funding people to work out how to be most relevant in the ways they formulated their calls. The problem that arises, it's a healthy practice, but the problem is that then you get an incestuous loop where the people who are informing the ways that the funding calls are put together happen to be the people who formulate their own calls, their own responses, the best way, and then, of course, they get the money. So it's very hard to work out where track history... It's almost like citational data, recurrent citational data that Ulf was talking about. People tend to be looked on favorably by the funders if they've been funded previously, and they can tell the right story about their outputs from the previous projects.
Can I ask what kind of artists you are in or working with in Brighton now?
Mm-hmm.
Are they connected formally to the university? Or are they independent artists? On what basis do you bring them in? What I'm interested in is, you know, how do you create that dynamics between the input from the artists and the input from the different faculties and other affordances that may come with the project?
Yeah, in Brighton at the moment, because for me it's still very new, and I'm just starting to build the environment for the artists. The terms of engagement are not nearly as sophisticated as what we had reached in Newcastle, for example, where we actually had residencies. But in Brighton, the sorts of artists we engage with, some of them are actually academic staff at the university, like Kirk Crawford, who has a dual role as an artist developer. Some of them are dancers coming from independent organizations or as independent individuals working into the project. And in this case, we try and find some kind of remuneration system so that their time is worth the investment in these sorts of projects. Mm. Sometimes they are PhD students. I have a PhD student at the moment who's a magician and a stand-up comedian, and I'm co-supervising with a philosopher because his subject is feedback loops and cybernetics in audience response. That's a very interesting project. But he is somebody who regularly gets engaged in the sort of artistic projects that we're developing. So in Newcastle, we had residencies, but not as formally as what you're planning to do, and certainly nowhere near as formally as what you've succeeded in doing in Switzerland. And sometimes those residents were people with mixed art academic backgrounds, and sometimes they were people completely from beyond the academy. So each time, I think that the profiles were very, very different. And I think my what I possibly learned, if I've learned anything, from Culture Lab was to ensure diversity of profiles, diversity of the configurations in which we're working, because what I'm very, very scared of is monolithic models which become a template. And I think the best way to shake up that kind of thing, if viability and sustainability of creative energies within an institution is to be upheld, then I think that means above all upholding diversity. It's a very simplistic kind of Varela type approach, but I think that if you don't have very different sorts of relationships and projects within an institution, then you're very quickly going to fall into a monotonous, repetitive model. Mm. I don't know, Ulf, your projects that you talked about, it seemed to me that they had extremely different idiosyncratic dynamics to them each time. They're individually driven.
That's true. That's also a certain problem.
Of course.
Because you have to change your knowledge.
Yeah.
All the months.
Yeah.
You have to be flexible.
But if you're not, it's not it's not
difficult,
real, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. I wonder, I'm just tossing in an idea, sort of. We're speaking about things we've done and which are successful, but we all tried many things that didn't work. And what's interesting, usually, it's at least as interesting as all the stuff we've tried that didn't work, all the programs, all the dreams we had, all the projects we wanted to, and so on.
Yeah.
If you compare your successful part or the ones that sort of you enjoyed, if you take out a real failure, what would happen then? Sort of, how would you?
I think you learn more from the failures, so-called failures. Yeah. I think they are. I don't think there's any such thing as a failure in what is a genuine research environment. For example, one of the motion capture projects that I had was to build up a sketch-based retrieval system for a motion capture database. So it was a very ambitious project, bringing together people from bioengineering and dance and interface design. And we built something that was so so abstract that it didn't have a hope in hell of ever going anywhere. But what it and what it really usefully did was to actually elucidate the complexity of the underlying questions, the dialogic blockages, the disciplinary irreducibility, the fact that we couldn't migrate concepts across the different groups. And the really funny thing is that I was at a point on that project, fortunately it was quite a short project, but I was at a point where I was saying, what am I going to be able to say about this? And to actually analyze this ostensible failure as actually an immense point of learning. We got a co-authored publication in Philosophical Transactions, which is probably the hardest scientific journal to get anything in the UK. And it's co-authored by 10 people who basically weren't speaking to each other by the end of the project. But, you know, that it's interesting because in terms of scientific reputation, it's a citational tool. It's a powerful one. And basically it tells the story of what we were unable to do. And in doing that, it says we succeeded in showing why we are unable to do this. So... I don't think there's... I think failure is a very dangerous term. If we're talking about art, we're talking about risk. Otherwise, we're not talking about art.
No, but if we go on sort of... On this line, but failure is of course one of the most important mechanisms in capitalism. I mean, this kind of idea that it has to do with success and, you know, this, and these ideas about management being successful and heroic and stuff like that. I mean, if there wasn't limited liability, there would be no capitalism. So the question is, how can we help each other to fail a little more, and,
yeah.
And how can we, are there maybe that's an art progress. That would be a very, very original art progress.
It's definitely a very good motto.
Yeah, because that is what I mean. That is what's happening. I mean, banks are going bankrupt and things, and it's a disaster. But the guys who are sort of running it, they get away with it, which is maybe a disaster too. But I mean, how could you get away with lots of failures and still sort of be able to continue? And could what is the mechanism for that? I don't know.
it's learning.
Hmm?
It's learning.
Yeah, but it's expensive learning. I mean, sort of, it could be. I mean,
it could be. Yeah, I mean, our failures were relatively modest, probably. But unfortunately, I wish they'd been more expensive. Yeah,
how does that go along with autonomy of art?
If art becomes such a servant of, say, field of errors for the ones who can't afford to How does that go along with autonomy? This on the discussion we have all the time about autonomy of the art field. Is that loosening at its borders, or what's happening there?
I see there is a certain change to heteronomy, but there is a raising consciousness of this too. So, in Zurich, for instance, where I asked the people who are visiting the exhibitions, there are about 2/3 of the visitors were thinking that collectors have too much power, for instance, which is an aspect of demand. Yeah. So I think this is a traditional kind of antagonism which is rising again.
Yeah, not,
in the
only,
field.
Not only collectors. Huh?
But
you remember Hamburg, the Participate Symposium we did?
Yeah.
It's also about bringing artists into urban development, which is hotly contested in art circles. This kind of artist participation in urban development projects, and how much autonomy and freedom there still is. So it's definitely a...
It's basically an instrumentalization of the artist for the anomias of the social state, you know.
That's what we ran into, yeah. This argument.
But you could say, I mean, I remember when a long, 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 long time ago I met people from that had been to Weissensee, the Art Academy and the DDR, this was closely to the Wendel, and then they were appalled by the fact that there were so many art students in the West. We knew that there were going to be 10 monuments of, you know, Honecker or Lening, and we needed 2 sculptures. Not 500. How can you ever feed these poor chaps? They can, stuff like that.
So I mean, that was sort of coming from the West. It was, of course, another perspective. Playing, you play. So there is, I don't know where I'm going with this kind of discussion. There's a play. You're playing with this people as capital. So you're investing this, and what's happening to them? And then there's art programs to take care of some of the victims of the investment of the state in art schools or something like that.
No,
so
this is only for the winners.
Oh, maybe you know, so there's a responsibility, and that was.